Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. I'm your host, Bo Spearham. Joining me in the studio this morning is Claire Land. Claire is an author, an academic as well, and also a very deadly activist from down in Melbourne, has worked for many years with the local Koori community down in Melbourne. She was a part of the 2006 Commonwealth Games protest down there in Melbourne, and also has written a really, really deadly book called Decolonizing Solidarity. And we're going to have a bit of a yarn about the book that she's written. It's a few years old now. It came out in 2014. And Claire, just before we start, could I get you just to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about yourself?
Thanks for having me, Bo. My name's Claire. I am non-Koori. Most of my family's from the British Isles and came to this land in the 1860s to the 1890s, although my grandfather came here from London in about the 30s. So I grew up in Canberra and moved down to Melbourne in 94 to go to university. And it was after I'd been at uni a couple of years and involved in the student union that I met some amazing political Aboriginal people and, just really started to really want to know about what had happened in this country and to get involved in some way supporting justice.
Is that why the move to Melbourne for university was Melbourne a more sort of socially conscious place at that time? Is that why you left, or just because they had better university classes or degrees, or away from the family?
Yeah, like both my parents, they had been to uni and they had both basically gone away to university, and so that was their tradition and that's what they encouraged. So I should go to a different city for university. My mum thought that I would move home. Back home after, but I didn't know she thought I was supposed to be moving home. Yeah. So I just stayed in Melbourne. But so my dad had moved to Melbourne he's from Victoria, and he had moved to Melbourne when I was about 8 years old. So then I knew Melbourne. I liked Melbourne. Mm. And it was a bigger place, bigger, sort of more exciting. So that's why I wanted to go there. And I hadn't been involved in any social activism or anything like that in Canberra, although my mum and her father, their side of the family, were very much involved in the ALP. So there was like a left wing slant to the family, and also my mum was quite influenced by feminism in the 70s and things like that. So she and all her friends were quite into that. So I guess I had a little bit of an interest. That's probably what made me end up at the student union and seek out that. But I hadn't been involved in anything.
What was you studying at the time?
I enrolled in arts and science because I just never had any idea what I wanted to. Still don't know what I'm going to do when I grow up. general degree. And I had quit studying history in year 9 at school. But then when I met Foley, then I diverted to my studies to actually study history. So that was inspiring.
And how long was that process before you met Foley and got involved, I guess, with the Koori community?
So I started uni in 94, got involved in the food co-op and the women's room, and then because I was sort of hanging around the student union, a couple of friends suggested that we run as representatives, student representatives. So I ran as a media representative, which basically meant editing the student paper. Mm-hmm. So I got elected in 97 to edit it in 98, and the two editors that I was elected with, one of them was in a history class with Gary Foley because he was a mature age student, and she suggested that we can make a connection with him since we were going to be editing the paper. And so I met him through their suggestion. Like, I didn't know, I hadn't heard of him, and so my education had not begun at all until then.
And then where to after that, I guess?
During that year, one of the first things he did was he said that there was this thing called the Training for Aboriginal Persons Scheme, which is like if a workplace would offer a sort of trainee situation for Aboriginal people, then they would be provided with a stipend, like an income. And so he introduced us to one amazing young guy and Luke Murray, who is Gary Murray's son, so from an amazing staunch family. And he was sort of transitioning out of being a VFL player into finishing up with sport and becoming kind of, you know, like a community worker. And Alistair Thorpe, who is like Robbie Thorpe's older brother, and I think he was in between things, and so it was good for him to have a platform to, you know, do stuff. So those two guys worked with us at the paper. So, like, Foley was throwing like these at us to sort of engage with, and then Jabaluka happened that year, and because Foley had already started educating us, like, you don't do anything until you've been asked. And then, like, I saw the posters for Jabaluka. It was like Aboriginal people asking non-Aboriginal people to do something, and I was like, well, so I got to do that sort of thing. So, went up there. And was part of the first mass arrest when I was up there.
And just for our listeners as well, give a bit of context about Jabaluka.
Oh, sorry, yeah. So Jabaluka was a struggle by the Mirar people up in the Kakadu National Park area, which had this like excised piece of land, which is where there was a uranium mine. So like right in the middle of the Kakadu National Park. So there was a thing called Ranger uranium mine, which had been going for a while. And then the company North Limited and CRA, it's now owned by Rio Tinto, but they wanted to set up a second mine, and that was Jabaluka. And so the locals were trying to combat that. And they employed Jackie Katona, who's a fantastic activist and a jock woman from up there. So she was the CEO. So she helped to fight that struggle with them. And part of that was calling out to Greenies students, anyone, church groups, whatever, to come and be part of a blockade to stop the mine. And so I just went up there as a participant. So that was, I guess, one thing I did that year. And also that year on campus, that 98 was when the 10-point plan was introduced to kill the Native Title Act, which was already flawed just anyway in terms of what it was going to provide to people in the southeast, like Brisbane through Melbourne and south of the Tropic of Capricorn, that area of, but the WIC judgment had come down around that Native title could exist on pastoral land, and so then that John Howard had brought in the 10-point plan to water down the Native Title Act. And so there were good intention white people in places like Victoria who were setting up groups called Defenders of Native Title, and a young law student, Nihal Bhutta, he set up a group called Defenders of Native Title. And then Foley, sort of, who was a student at the time, said, well, look, we don't even want Native Title, so can you just like start again, like change the name of that group. And so it became Students for Land Justice and Reconciliation. And so once I'd finished editing the student paper, I joined that group, and so that became a collective place to express this kind of support impulse I had.
And going to Jabaluka as well and being up there, did you get arrested or no?
When we got up there, that it was sort of like in the university school holidays, and so a lot of non-Indigenous uni activists had gone up there in July, and so there was big numbers at the camp at that time, and so it was a moment where strategically the organisers suggested a mass arrest so to grab media attention. So it was a deliberate mass arrest action by hundreds of people at the camp. I think it was like 125, 135 people got arrested by just going to the mine site, sitting down in front of the gates and just stopping the whatever work going on that day. And so it was just like the police like directed us to move, and then we didn't, and so then we all got arrested and put in and taken to Darwin. And yeah, it was a good strategy because it was it got the media attention as hoped. But during that time, like, Mirar people were also arrested, like, for trespass, all this sort of stuff. Most of the protesters, when they went up there, were given passports, like Mirar passports, to say you're allowed to be here, but you've got to follow these rules and stuff like that. So.
If you're just tuning into the program, my guest is Claire Land, and we're having a yarn about her early days in, I guess, the activist circle and her early activism that she's been involved in for quite some time now, going to university down in Melbourne, visiting and being a part of the Jabiluka actions up in Kakadu, and then also, you know, being introduced to Gary Foley and immersing in, I guess, Aboriginal politics and understanding the struggle of Aboriginal people. That obviously came through hanging around and being involved at the university with Gary Foley and some of his other fellows.
Yeah, and it was a great time to be there because yeah, like I met Tony Birch then as well, and the same crew is now at Victoria Uni, which is great. So it's like another moment when people are all there, and I learned a lot from other people around there that at the time, like the late Lisa Belier was there, Lillian Holt was there too. She became the director of the Koori unit there. The Koori unit itself was an amazing spot because it was in an old childcare center and it had a play area, and there was a fire, there was a potential for a fire, there was a fire pit, and so people could hang out there. It was really, really great. It's closed down now, but that was a place where people mixed and gathered and got to know each other. So there was an Indigenous student collective and the Students for Land Justice and Reconciliation, and so there were these two collectives, and they could have a really great sort of, you know, group to group cooperation instance there. And Lillian Holt has often spoken about the idea of interrogating whiteness, and so that was a really great situation to be in a political group and invited to interrogate whiteness, and so doing that through an instance of being like open to learning, because a lot of people there's something be interesting to talk to you about. A lot of non-Indigenous white middle-class people, not all non-Indigenous people will be like this, but some people are really defensive, and even the idea of white privilege like that would just freak people out and they would just not be open to that. But we were in an instance where, in a circumstance that those ideas were something that we were happy to interrogate. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's not a finishable, it's not a project you can finish, but she was really influential in introducing that idea too. So, yeah, there were some really influential educators around.
And that was sort of a stepping stone into you writing your book. And before it was a book, it was just a PhD study that you were doing as well, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. So I did honours in history, wanted to look at, like, you know, colonialism and colonial history in Victoria, and then worked for a while and then wanted to find a question to find me so that I would be able to do a PhD that would have some relationship to sort of like work and in the community, as opposed to, I would have been quite interested to do a history PhD, but wanted to find something maybe more practical. And so I guess like Foley had certainly like alerted me very early on of some guidelines of like not doing something unless you've been asked to do it, that, this kind of thing, and like the importance of knowing history, and particularly like wanting to find out the Aboriginal political struggle as opposed to any other types of things, like being like really wanting to find out culture and things like that, which is not something that he would guide us towards. He was guiding us towards wanting to us to understand Aboriginal people like as staunch political resistance and not like some exotic kind of passive thing, or like, if you know what I mean, it's weird to put those sort of words around it, but that was always the strong focus of political history, Indigenous struggles. So the PhD, it certainly came out of him alerting me to the problems. Like, for instance, when I was in Sledger, the Students for Land Justice and Reconciliation, Foley was the representative in Melbourne for the Mirar in relation to the Jabiluka dispute. They had asked him to be the representative, and so he then had to attend the Jabiluka Action Group meetings and, you know, help to inspire and organise the non-Aboriginal people to go up and be part of this blockade or do things in Melbourne. And he said to us at Sledger, like, you got to come and watch watch what happens at these Jabiluka Action Group meetings because it's quite racist. And I was like, okay, well, and so I went along and watched. So in that sense, there was always...
Did you pick up on sort of the stuff that Gary Foley was talking about, like what was like racist in that there as well? Like, did you sort of understand where the point of view where he was coming from or...?
Yeah, I guess it's... I found that it was... One thing I observed was that, like just the disrespect that people would, like, be arguing back against him of what he was suggesting needed to be done, I found, and that was quite disrespectful. Like, people would have had no idea what, like, his experience and why he would say those things. And but so he would, like, basically he might say something like, well, that's really racist. We'll talk about it afterwards at the pub. Yeah. And so, like, there was always this... generosity to spend, like, to both to name and call out the sort of not to say, look, this is problematic, but then a complete generosity to, like, talk through that. So I found that amazing to see.
And so around this period of, so when did you start your PhD? And then was it always that name as well, like Decolonising Solidarity? How did you come up with that name?
Yeah. Well, I started the PhD in 2006, actually, like just after the Games, the Stolenworth Games. And the idea Decolonising Solidarity, that kind of came up, I think it's probably was in the lead up to the Games. Might have been even... I don't know the exact timeline, but I was broadcasting on 3CR Community Radio with Robbie Thorpe from 2003 till like 2013-14, and it was in that early time that we had a conversation, and I was I think solidarity needs to be decolonised, but the that lingo came out of this book written by the Maori scholar Linda Tuhiwai Smith, who'd written a book called Decolonising Methodologies. And in that in itself came from, I would think, a book by a Kenyan scholar, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, and that was Decolonising the Mind. And that was about people in... decolonized African countries, so where the colonizers had departed and gone home back to Europe, but that colonial ideas still were inside the native people, and they were trying to decolonize themselves. And like, especially for him, he was a writer, he was like grappling with this idea that he should actually write in his native languages and not write in the languages of the colonizer. So like that decolonizing for the native person. And then so for this, the Decolonising Solidarity was sort of to say that like the settler and people of colonial backgrounds have been like shaped by colonialism too, and so need to like get rid of those colonial ideas. But also, so that solidarity, I'd been shown by Foley that people who want to be supportive of Aboriginal struggles can be racist and paternalising, like even in trying to be supportive. But also that... that sometimes non-Aboriginal people, they want to support Aboriginal struggles, but they might be sort of feel more comfortable and inspired around ideas like reconciliation. But it's more important to be like that. That's sort of a distraction from the real issues of return of land and self-determination. So that solidarity in itself should be a force for decolonisation. So there's the two sides to it.
And if you're just tuning in to Let's Talk, my guest on the program is Claire Land. We've been yarning a bit about her book and also, I guess, some of the stuff that led her to writing Decolonising for Solidarity. We're actually just going to go to a quick song break, and this song is by Rumpy Band, Black Fella, White Fella. And you are listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM.
Real fella, all the people of different races. with different lives in different places. It doesn't matter what your name is. We got to help. Lots of changes. We need more brothers if we're to make it. We need more sisters if we're to save it. Are you the one who's gonna stand up and be counted? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we shout it? Are you the one who's always ready with a helping hand? Are you the one who understands this family plan? Black fella, white fella, a yellow fella, any fella, it doesn't matter what you color, as long as you a true fella. All the people of different races with different lives in different places, it doesn't matter which religions, it's all the same. Where the ship is sinking, we need more brothers if we're to make it. We need more sisters, if we can save it. Are you the one who's gonna stand up and be counted? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we shout it? Are you the one who's always ready with a helping hand? Are you the one who understands this family plan?
Let's Talk. And you're back on Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM. I'm your host, Bo Spearham, and my guest is Claire Land. We're having a yarn about her book, Decolonizing Solidarity. And just before we get back into the interview, that song was Black Fella, White Fella by Rumpy Band. In this discussion of decolonization as well, it's never really spoken about in that context of where it's just not the indigenous peoples that need to decolonize as well. I guess in writing this book and also hearing, I guess, the feedback that you got from it, was this sort of like a light bulb moment for lots of people that approached you as well? Lots of non-Aboriginal people, like thinking, oh, well, yeah, like I'm a part of this, you know, decolonizing actually, you know, is something that I need to do as well?
Yeah, yep. I have had that kind of feedback, which has been really fantastic, that sometimes people will send me like a messenger message on Facebook to say, hi, I just want to tell you, I read the book and thank you because it's made me really think and changed my view on things. And so that's really inspiring. And so...
Because like we forget, I guess, one point in time, everybody on this earth was indigenous and people forget like their indigeneity as well. Like they sort of forget that, you know, like that decolonizing process and that they have to go through as well.
And like really being able to answer the question of where are you from?
Yeah.
Like really, like when did your family come to be here and where were they from and what was their, you know, beliefs and cultures and things like that. And, yeah, I think that's really important that people seek to even answer that question.
Did you have this understanding before you wrote the book and hanging around, you know, with all the Koori mob that you were around that time would have sort of brought you to this thinking of, you know, where I come from? Was that always something prior to your involvement within, you know, activism and hanging around, you know, the Koori mob? Was this always, you know, who am I and where am I from?
No, I would not say that. No, not really. I mean, look, there's family history that I was sort of like aware of to like my great grandparents and stuff. and yeah, interested in that, but not, I hadn't pursued that. That became something that's really important because of meeting Aboriginal people and and sort of really that question being there. Just, yeah. So I'm lucky because my dad has been doing a lot of family history, so that's really enriched me then. And like my uncle on my mum's side, he's done some family history, so that's also been really great. But I'm sure there's lots more there, kind of thing. And I also should say, like, when the idea for the decolonising solidarity and all that sort of stuff, and I wanted to find out as much as I could about the politics of solidarity, and partly that's because there have been times when, I'm part of the problem too, so I'd done things that, you know, weren't nice for other Aboriginal people and things. So, you know, I'd learnt by trial and error, and what that really means is harming Aboriginal people. So then I guess there was kind of like, I knew that I needed to know as much as I could, like, understand this better. Plus also I wanted for there to be like something that non-Aboriginal people could read so that they didn't learn by trial and error, so they didn't learn by harming Aboriginal people. So and again, that came from that political scene that I was involved in, and Foley had written on it. He'd written an article called Whiteness and Blackness, Strategic Considerations in the Koori Struggle for Land Rights, Self-Determination and Economic Independence. And so he'd gone through a whole lot of case studies of times throughout history where the dynamics between the supporter people and then the Aboriginal people that they were supporting, where those dynamics had been conflict, and then the white people had been taking over or had resisted, like, giving over, like, power to Aboriginal people. And, like, you could just see that there'd be in this problems over history, and that something it would be great if there was something there to inform people to maybe avoid some of those problems happening again. And like one of the really good examples of this kind of conflict was within FACATSI, the Federal Council for the Advancement of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, and that was around in like the 50s and 60s, and it was responsible for the government agreeing to hold the 67 referendum and then making sure that there was a yes vote. And yet, so it was a very big national-based organisation, but, like, the exec positions, like president, whatever, secretary, they were held by white people. So
and I think as well,
very aware of all that.
Yeah, and that's where Tribal Council came from. Hani Uzru, Nuckle, and who else was there?
I think Stuart Murray, Doug Nichols, those
people.
And Joe McGinnis.
There was quite a few. I forgot who I was talking to, and I was saying, yeah, like, they pushed a motion that should be just the Aboriginal members voting on, have the last say on, you know, the things that, you know, that they're going to run, and there was a big disagreement. They said, well, hey, you know, if that's the case, then we're out. And then, you know, started, you know, Tribal Council, which was an organisation within itself, was deadly, and, you know, sort of pushed. You can sort of see how that shaped, you know, the activism and the movement for generations to come after that. Not long after that, we had things like Ten Embassy and these massive big mobilisations all over the country in those, you know, 70s and 80s. But back to the book as well, how important is it, you know, I guess, for non-Aboriginal people to sort of have that discussion of, you know, decolonising?
I think it's really important. I had seen an example. So at the 2006 Stolen Wealth Games in Melbourne, there was even a time when there was a conflict there about the behaviour of non-Aboriginal people. And then what happened was, so Aboriginal people had said, oh, look, could you, it's great that you're supporting, but could you just support during the day but not stay at the camp? And then what happened was most non-Aboriginal people were upset, hurt and confused and just withdrew support. And it's just like, but you're being asked by the people you're supporting just to do it in this slightly different way. What's the problem? Like, and I guess I learned a lot in the PhD to see, like, how that might have been avoided, because I was involved in the non-Indigenous, like, side of things for the Black GST and the Stolen Wealth Games, and I would have learnt a lot in the time of doing the PhD that I would have done it differently then. And one thing, I think it's good to assume that conflicts and tensions will come up. Because the world is racist, then people get shaped by that, and so of course things are going to be going to act, people might be have racism in them and maybe be paternalistic sort of by tendency, not by like intention. And so it's good to have a little group that like already is meeting and talking about those issues, so that when the issues inevitably come up, then there's more of a capacity to work through them in a constructive way. So but it's always important to do the reflecting and the acting at the same time. So not like being like, sorry, we can't lock on because we're reflecting. Like, you know, so obviously there's political urgencies that you've got to do. But it's good that if there is more reflection and that non-Aboriginal people will challenge and support each other to raise their own level of understanding of these issues, so that not that Aboriginal people don't have to do that educating. But so also like to build supportive relationships with each other, like because I think non-Indigenous people can even hold each other in suspicion, like, oh, they might turn out racist, so we're not going to associate, as opposed to there are other really good examples of non-Aboriginal groups like Sledger that I mentioned before, the student group, and there was a group called the Melbourne Kungas who supported the Cooper Pedy Kunga Judo, which was the senior Aboriginal women in Cooper Pedy trying to stop the waste dump. The Melbourne Kungas, they set themselves up as a collective and had a kind of collective approach to how they wanted to work. They'd sorted that out, they'd worked through, they trusted each other, and they identified as a group. And so they trusted each other and they held each other accountable and responsible. And I think that's a really good and strong thing. That you could just say, yeah, I'm a Melbourne Kunga, and that would be the group was trusted by Aboriginal people.
And did you see these, did you sort of, obviously this sort of helped you shape the book as well, you know, these experiences with the student groups and the Kunga group as well. What other, I guess, outside of the Koori community that you're involved in as well, was sort of, I guess, guiding you to sort of have this understanding as well?
In the year 2000, I went with the University Students for East Timor, the Timor Freedom Support Group at Melbourne Uni. I went with them over to Timor because they'd been working with Timorese uni students and pro-democracy people and people trying to get independence. And so they'd invited this group over to go there. And I was like, great, it's an invitation. So, you know, again, that's an instance where you would sort of say, yes, you'll do something. You don't go uninvited. And was actually being there and feeling how different it was to be like relating to the Timorese students and how different that was to the just the feeling of the relating with Aboriginal students at Melbourne Uni, and just going, oh, this is so much easier in Timor. There's less tension there. And it was just purely the less direct complicity of not being an actual coloniser that created a less tense personal reaction. And it was probably just from my side of like guilt and knowing of being illegitimate, and like there's not a treaty so you can't at all feel like it's okay to be there, and that made me reflect back about, I need, wanted to understand more about that scene here. So that I had, there were a couple of really good people when I was in that kind of more, I guess, international aid solidarity thing, some non-Aboriginal older workers who were a good role model, I'd say. So there were those, because I think there's a really strong similarity between like the Aboriginal community controlled like movement of like how Aboriginal people want to work together to be ethical and powerful and staunch as community workers within their own communities. It's really quite similar to community development principles. And so the international solidarity, that was a quite a similar thing. So you could see it in a framework, see the work of solidarity within the framework of being an outsider from a more privileged background. So it was sort of helpful to have that frame, I think.
And what time was it around when you started writing, doing the PhD, around the early
2000s? 2006. I started the PhD, so it was a bunch of reading and thinking about like how to do interviews and like whether it was like, given that Aboriginal people have been like over researched, like would it be okay to interview Aboriginal people? Is that like a bad dynamic, or whether it's just like silly to not have Aboriginal voices in a project like this? and so ethical questions and stuff like that. And then, like, I actually did the interviews in 2008 because I had my first baby at the 12-month mark of the PhD. And then so I took, like, 8 months off there, then went back, did 6 more months and then had another baby. So I did the interviews when I was 6 months pregnant or so. And then, yeah, and then finally completed the PhD at the very end of 2011. Then it got awarded in 2012 and then took forever to...
So, and then you wanted to publish it?
Yeah, I mean, for about a year after I'd finished the PhD, I didn't think that it... I was like, oh, well, like... Who would want to read that? Like, what's the, it's all common sense. Like, I didn't come up with anything that people don't already know if they think about it, and not having the confidence to think that it was worthwhile. But then, you know, after that, got over that, and took forever to pitch the book, and yeah. But so it finally came out in late 2015.
And it's been received really, really well.
Reckon it has. It's had some really good reviews. It did. There was a really early and positive review, which was really amazing, by Genevieve Greaves and Maddie Clark. Fantastic young staunch writers. And then it's been reviewed in quite a few academic journals. There was one really fair enough critique that, well, what about non-white supporters? Like, what about people of colour? Like, what's the politics of solidarity in that regard? And so that was a critique from Turtle Island, from Canada, and that's fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so that's something. And people of colour who have read the book have also sort of said, well, so what's... Where do I sit? So then there's a question there to think, well, I need to be able to address people. Like, I wanted to put the focus, like, I feel like non-white people are the more the worst tendencies towards being problematic in this kind of space. But in a way, just focusing on white people and interrogating that can just mean, like, that white people appear to be the more important or the centre of things. And so that's... a problem. So so I have sort of like started to try to write a little bit. So Foley had his article Whiteness and Blackness, and so I thought I might write something called Whiteness and Blackness and Blackness. So I just wrote a little paper at one point about that. So I've had some really great responses. Like, one of the best responses I got was like a message from someone in like Europe saying, I just want to let you know that there's a lot of young Romani intellectuals who've been reading the book. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. Like, how cool is that it could be used by people in their own instance, like, you know, to inform their own, critiques of their supporters. And
yeah, that's cool.
That was pretty cool. And then, so I actually got a printout of the sales of the book. And it's actually increased each year.
So that article, Whiteness and Blackness and Blackness, was that sort of trying to go on from when there was people of colour saying, hey, you're like, where do we stand,
So I did give a talk of that, and then I kind of maybe, I sort of tried to write it into maybe something that could be published, but I haven't, like, put it, so I thought it would be good to, like, maybe, like, just put it in a, like, you know, activist magazine or something like that. But I haven't, like, done anything except for giving the talk and then trying to write it up a bit.
Since, I guess, the book's been coming out, you've been travelling a bit as well, doing readings and stuff.
So I did have the chance to go to New York City, which was pretty cool. So I got an invite, didn't get a flight, so I had to pay for that, but that's okay because, like, so exciting, like, New York City, how exciting. So I was on a panel with this other person who'd written a book. Like, we went through the same thing at Melbourne Uni, Emma Koval. She's written a book called Trapped in the Gap, Doing Good in Indigenous Australia. So, like, we'd come through the exact same, like, political moment at Melbourne Uni.
You knew each other as well?
Yeah, we were even housemates once.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and so we'd, and even, so we put, basically ended up writing this book at the same time. So it's similar, although she'd done hers was like like an anthropology where she was like anthropologizing like white health workers in the Northern Territory, like what is the culture of white health workers kind of thing. So that, you know, that was her focus. So we did a talk, and then I spoke at an anarchist bookshop in New York City as well. And I did go and I have spoken in Aotearoa, so I got like a ticket there from like my job to go and attend a conference, and then like organised a workshop there, which is really, really great. There's this woman there called Jen Margaret. She's a Pākehā treaty worker, so non-Aboriginal, non-Māori person who tries to educate other non-Māori about the treaty and how to honour that. So she's sort of pretty similar to me over there. And then Sina Anna Brown Davis, she's moved home from Melbourne to there, and so we did the workshop together. So there's been times when, and then someone set up a book club in Wellington. So yeah, there's now a book club for the book, for people who are wanting to read the book and discuss it in a group. There's a package of like discussion questions and like a program of like six meetings that you could do one per month, all read the book together and like discuss it, work out how to apply it in your own circumstance, and maybe give a bit of inspiration to plow through it, because maybe it can be a long hard read. And also as part of that, this was with one activist educator called Holly Hammond, non-Aboriginal person, and another non-Aboriginal woman, Prue Gell. So they helped to create the questions and to train up.
That's not a part of the book? Like you didn't put that as a...
No, that was written after. But anyone can do it. It's available to be just taken up as a resource. And, yeah, so like 20 groups set themselves up to read the book. That was pretty awesome. With the book club resources, including guidelines that we'd written, like how to have a conversation with a mostly non-Aboriginal, or maybe all non-Aboriginal people. Like how could you have a conversation that wouldn't be dodgy? And like keep yourself on the right topics and stuff like
that's
that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And just in closing as well, some of the thoughts in the book, I guess, that stand out for you as well, that you would like to share with our listeners, just in wrapping up, anything that you'd like to sort of, I guess, shout out to our listeners in terms of being a good ally or showing, you know, proper solidarity to, I guess, in the context of, you know, our country, to Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people?
Well, there's the self-reflecting of those question of where am I really from, like how has racism found its way into me and the way I act. And then there's like practical suggestions of like what are some of the things you could do in support, and examples of those sorts of things. And then there's also like asking people to question their own complicity and their own, like, and this is really great way to get to this question is like Aileen Morton Robinson, who's from up here.
Yeah, over from the island there too, where Pākehā is.
Right, okay. So she had written this kind of amazing question where at one point, it was within an anecdote, but she had said that she asked a non-Indigenous, a white woman, what were the limits to what she would do in solidarity? Like, and when you ask yourself that, that's when you find out how you are entangled in being a colonial person.
Yeah.
Like, would you stop voting? Would you, like, give up any land titles you have? Like, what are the limits? Like, and if you find that out, then you can see how you're implicated and also how you could turn that entanglement into a place where you could resist. And, yeah, so I think that that's an interesting thing, again, just trying to collect up the ideas from other people and put them in one place for people to reflect on.
Do you have any of the, I guess, for example, some of the stuff you do or some of the stuff non-Aboriginal friends of yours have sort of done, you know, in the past or now as well?
Yeah, well, there's a little group of pay the rent people. I think that's quite interesting of like... if this is Aboriginal land, then shouldn't Aboriginal people be the landlords? Like, how did they? How could you like express your conviction that this is Aboriginal land by actually paying the rent? And so that can sometimes be like complicated ways of like how do you do that and things like that. But I often find that it's the people who are the most lacking in resources that will be the ones that are most committed to actually paying the rent. So like this radical lesbian feminist group, when they have their conferences and get-togethers, they always pay the rent, and they're the ones that got almost nothing.
Yeah.
They're always broke as, but they always manage to put 10% of the budget for their endeavours towards something that's a bit like pay the rent, like it'll be donated to an Aboriginal women's project, or it'll be donated for Aboriginal women to say, Aboriginal women in that group to say, well, what should it go to, and you know, things like that.
I think where can people find your book?
You can order it online. If you're in Brisbane, then you can get it from the Institute of Modern Art. In Melbourne and Sydney, places like Readings or Dura Books, the Anarchist Bookshop in Sydney, or like Glebe Books. And then you can also order it like from those bookstores online, or you can get it from the Book Depository. That's a cheap way, pretty cheap way to get it. But it's probably not the most ethical because they kind of like from Amazon. Yeah, but you can get the Kindle version of it as well if you want that. And also another good way to get it is to ask your local library to buy it, and then you can read it and then others can get it too.
Yeah, deadly, deadly. Thanks for joining us in the studio this morning, Claire, and having out about your book. Very, very deadly book. If you are interested in reading the book, by all means, please get out there and ask your library to book the book, to get the book, Claire was just saying, or order it online. You know, very, very deadly book. And thanks for joining us this morning.
No worries. And you can always search up my website, and then I've got an email so you can get in touch if you're having trouble getting it or whatever. Want to find out about the book club, you can get it. So it's Decolonising Solidarity is the, just with a Z, so just search that up.
And oh, so that's your website.
Yep.
Okay, well, there you go. You've been tuning in to Let's Talk. I'm your host, Bo Spearham. My guest has been Claire Land. If you'd like to listen to the repeat of the show, it is repeated at 7 p.m. Tonight. You can catch Let's Talk Monday to Friday, or you could go on to 989fm.com.au, follow the links to the podcast and Let's Talk, and you'll find a copy online of this interview. You are listening to 989FM.